world of Crustacea. I went along, climbing the rocks, striding over extended trunks, breaking the sea bindweed which hung from one tree to the other, and frightening the fishes, which flew from branch to branch. Pressing onward, I felt no fatigue. I followed my guide, who was never tired. What a spectacle! How can I express it? How paint the aspect of those woods and rocks in this medium? Their underparts dark and wild, the upper colored with red tints, by that light which the reflecting powers of the waters doubled. We climbed rocks which fell directly after with gigantic bounds and the low growling of an avalanche. To right and left ran long, dark galleries where sight was lost. Here opened vast glades which the hand of man seemed to have worked. And I sometimes asked myself if some inhabitant of these submarine regions would not suddenly appear to me. But Captain Nemo was still mounting. I could not stay behind. I followed boldly. My stick gave me good help. A false step would have been dangerous on the narrow passes sloping down to the sides of the gulfs. But I walked with firm step, without feeling any giddiness. Now I jumped a crevice, the depth of which would have made me hesitate had it been among the glaciers on the land. Now I ventured on the unsteady trunk of a tree thrown across from one abyss to the other, without looking under my feet, having only eyes to admire the wild sights of this region. There, monumental rocks, leaning on their regularly cut bases, seemed to defy all laws of equilibrium. From between their stony knees, trees sprang, like a jet under heavy pressure, and upheld others which upheld them. Natural towers, large scarps, cut perpendicularly like a curtain, inclined at an angle which the laws of gravitation could never have tolerated in terrestrial regions. 2 hours after quitting the Nautilus, we had crossed the line of trees, and 100 feet above our heads rose the top of the mountain, which cast a shadow on the brilliant irradiation of the opposite slope. Some petrified shrubs ran fantastically here and there. Fishes got up under our feet like birds in the long grass. The massive rocks were rent with impenetrable fractures, deep grottos, and unfathomable holes, at the bottom of which formidable creatures might be heard moving. My blood curdled when I saw enormous antennae blocking my road, or some frightful claw closing with a noise in the shadow of some cavity. Millions of luminous spots shone brightly in the midst of the darkness. They were the eyes of giant crustacea crouched in their holes, giant lobsters setting themselves up like halberdiers, and moving their claws with the clicking sound of pincers, titanic crabs pointed like a gun on its carriage, and frightful-looking octopi interweaving their tentacles like a living nest of serpents. We had now arrived on the first platform, where other surprises awaited me. Before us lay some picturesque ruins, which betrayed the hand of man and not that of the Creator. There were vast heaps of stone, amongst which might be traced the vague and shadowy forms of castles and temples, clothed with a world of blossoming zoophytes, and over which, instead of ivy, seaweed and fucus threw a thick vegetable mantle. But what was this portion of the globe which had been swallowed by cataclysms? Who had placed those rocks and stones like cromlechs of prehistoric times? Where was I? Whither had Captain Nemo's fancy hurried me? I would fain have asked him. Not being able to, I stopped him. I seized his arm. But, shaking his head and pointing to the highest point of the mountain, he seemed to say, "Come, come along, come higher." I followed, and in a few minutes I had climbed to the top, which for a circle of 10 yards commanded the whole mass of rock. I looked down the side we had just climbed. The mountain did not rise more than 700 or 800 feet above the level of the plain. But on the opposite side it commanded from twice that height the depths of this part of the Atlantic. My eyes ranged far over a large space lit by a violent fulguration. In fact, the mountain was a volcano. At 50 feet above the peak, in the midst of a rain of stones and scoriae, a large crater was vomiting forth torrents of lava, which fell in a cascade of fire into the bosom of the liquid mass. Thus situated, this volcano lit the lower plain like an immense torch, even to the extreme limits of the horizon. I said that the submarine crater threw up lava, but no flames. Flames require the oxygen of the air to feed upon and cannot be developed under water. But streams of lava, having in themselves the principles of their incandescence, can attain a white heat, fight vigorously against the liquid element, and turn it to vapor by contact. Rapid currents bearing all these gases in diffusion and torrents of lava slid to the bottom of the mountain like an eruption of Vesuvius on another Terra del Greco. There indeed, under my eyes, ruined, destroyed, lay a town, its roofs open to the sky, its temples fallen, its arches dislocated, its columns lying on the ground, from which one would still recognize the massive character of Tuscan architecture. Further on, some remains of a gigantic aqueduct. Here the high base of an Acropolis, with the floating outline of a Parthenon. There traces of a quay, as if an ancient port had formerly abutted on the borders of the ocean, and disappeared with its merchant vessels and its war galleys. Farther on again, long lines of sunken walls and broad deserted streets. A perfect Pompeii escaped beneath the waters. Such was the sight that Captain Nemo brought before my eyes. Where was I? Where was I? I must know at any cost. I tried to speak, but Captain Nemo stopped me by a gesture, and picking up a piece of chalkstone, advanced to a rock of black basalt, and traced the one word, Atlantis. What a light shot through my mind! Atlantis! The Atlantis of Plato, that continent denied by Origen and Humboldt, who placed its disappearance amongst the legendary tales. I had it there now before my eyes, bearing upon it the unexceptionable testimony of its catastrophe. The region thus engulfed was beyond Europe, Asia, and Libya, beyond the columns of Hercules, where those powerful people, the Atlantides, lived, against whom the first wars of ancient Greeks were waged. Thus, led by the strangest destiny, I was treading underfoot the mountains of this continent, touching with my hand those ruins 1,000 generations old and contemporary with the geological epochs. I was walking on the very spot where the contemporaries of the first man had walked. Whilst I was trying to fix in my mind every detail of this grand landscape, Captain Nemo remained motionless, as if petrified in mute ecstasy, leaning on a mossy stone. Was he dreaming of those generations long since disappeared? Was he asking them the secret of human destiny? Was it here this strange man came to steep himself in historical recollections, and live again this ancient life, he who wanted no modern one? What would I not have given to know his thoughts, to share them, to understand them? We remained for an hour at this place, contemplating the vast plains under the brightness of the lava, which was sometimes wonderfully intense. Rapid tremblings ran along the mountain caused by internal bubblings. Deep noises, distinctly transmitted through the liquid medium, were echoed with majestic grandeur. At this moment, the moon appeared through the mass of waters and threw her pale rays on the buried continent. It was but a gleam, but what an indescribable effect! The captain rose, cast one last look on the immense plain, and then bade me follow him. We descended the mountain rapidly, and the mineral forest once passed, I saw the lantern of the Nautilus shining like a star. The captain walked straight to it, and we got on board as the first rays of light whitened the surface of the ocean. Chapter 10. The Submarine Coal Mines. The next day, the 20th of February, I awoke very late. The fatigues of the previous night had prolonged my sleep until 11 o'clock. I dressed quickly and hastened to find the course the Nautilus was taking. The instruments showed it to be still toward the south, with a speed of 20 miles an hour and a depth of 50 fathoms. The species of fishes here did not differ much from those already noticed. There were rays of giant size, 5 yards long, and endowed with great muscular strength, which enabled them to shoot above the waves. Sharks of many kinds, amongst others one 15 feet long, with triangular sharp teeth, and whose transparency rendered it almost invisible in the water. Amongst bony fish, Conseil noticed some about 3 yards long, armed at the upper jaw with a piercing sword. Other bright-colored creatures, known in the time of Aristotle by the name of the sea dragon, which are dangerous to capture on account of the spikes on their back. About 4 o'clock, the soil, generally composed of a thick mud mixed with petrified wood, changed by degrees, and it became more stony, and seemed strewn with conglomerate and pieces of basalt, with a sprinkling of lava. I thought that a mountainous region was succeeding the long plains, and accordingly, after a few evolutions of the Nautilus, I saw the southerly horizon blocked by a high wall which seemed to close all exit. Its summit evidently passed the level of the ocean. It must be a continent, or at least an island, one of the Canaries or of the Cape Verde Islands. The bearings not being yet taken, perhaps designedly, I was ignorant of our exact position. In any case, such a wall seemed to me to mark the limits of that Atlantis, of which we had in reality passed over only the smallest part. Much longer should I have remained at the window admiring the beauties of sea and sky, but the panels closed. At this moment the Nautilus arrived at the side of this high, perpendicular wall. What it would do I could not guess. I returned to my room. It no longer moved. I laid myself down with the full intention of waking after a few hours' sleep. But it was 8 o'clock the next day when I entered the saloon. I looked at the manometer. It told me that the Nautilus was floating on the surface of the ocean. Besides, I heard steps on the platform. I went to the panel. It was open. But instead of broad daylight, as I expected, I was surrounded by profound darkness. Where were we? Was I mistaken? Was it still night? No, not a star was shining, and night has not that utter darkness. I knew not what to think, when a voice near me said, "Is that you, Professor?" "Ah, Captain," I answered, "where are we?"
"Underground, sir."
"Underground?" I exclaimed. "And the Nautilus floating still?"
"It always floats."
"But I do not understand."
"Wait a few minutes. Our lantern will be lit, and if you like light places, you will be satisfied."
I stood on the platform and waited. The darkness was so complete that I could not even see Captain Nemo. But looking to the zenith, exactly above my head, I seemed to catch an undecided gleam, a kind of twilight, filling a circular hole. At this instant the lantern was lit, and its vividness dispelled the faint light. I closed my dazzled eyes for an instant, and then looked again. The Nautilus was stationary, floating near a mountain which formed a sort of key. The lake, then, supporting it, was a lake imprisoned by a circle of walls, measuring 2 miles in diameter and 6 in circumference. Its level, the manometer showed, could only be the same as the outside level, for there must necessarily be a communication between the lake and the sea. The high partitions, leaning forward on their base, grew into a vaulted roof bearing the shape of an immense funnel turned upside down, the height being about 500 or 600 yards. At the summit was a circular orifice, by which I had caught the slight gleam of light, evidently daylight. "Where are we?" I asked. "In the very heart of an extinct volcano, the interior of which has been invaded by the sea after some great convulsion of the earth. Whilst you were sleeping, Professor, the Nautilus penetrated to this lagoon by a natural canal, which opens about 10 yards beneath the surface of the ocean. This is its harbor of refuge, a sure, commodious, and mysterious one, sheltered from all gales. Show me, if you can, on the coasts of any of your continents or islands, a road which can give such perfect refuge from all storms." "Certainly,"
I replied. You are in safety here, Captain Nemo.
Who could reach you in the heart of a volcano?
But did I not see an opening at its summit?
Yes, its crater, formerly filled with lava, vapor, and flames, and which now gives entrance to the life-giving air we breathe.
But what is this volcanic mountain?
It belongs to one of the numerous islands with which this sea is strewn. To vessels, a simple sandbank. To us, an immense cavern. Chance led me to discover it, and chance served me well.
But of what use is this refuge, Captain?
The Nautilus wants no port.
No, sir, but it wants electricity to make it move, and the wherewithal to make the electricity.
Sodium to feed the elements, coal from which to get the sodium, and a coal mine to supply the coal. And exactly on this spot, the sea covers entire forests embedded during the geological periods, now mineralized and transformed into coal. For me, they are an inexhaustible mine.
Your men follow the trade of miners here, then, Captain?
Exactly so. These mines extend under the waves like the mines of Newcastle. Here, in their diving dresses, pickaxe and shovel in hand, my men extract the coal, which I do not even ask from the mines of the earth. When I burn this combustible for the manufacture of sodium, the smoke, escaping from the crater of the mountain, gives it the appearance of a still active volcano.
And we shall see your companions at work?
No, not this time at least, for I am in a hurry to continue our submarine tour of the earth. So I shall content myself with drawing from the reserve of sodium I already possess. The time for loading is one day only, and we continue our voyage. So if you wish to go over the cavern and make the round of the lagoon, you must take advantage of today, Monsieur Aronnax.
I thanked the captain and went to look for my companions, who had not yet left their cabin. I invited them to follow me without saying where we were. They mounted the platform. Conseil, who was astonished at nothing, seemed to look upon it as quite natural that he should wake under a mountain, after having fallen asleep under the waves. But Ned Land thought of nothing but finding whether the cavern had any exit. After breakfast, about 10 o'clock, we went down onto the mountain.
"Here we are, once more on land," said Conseil.
"I do not call this land," said the Canadian, "and besides, we are not on it, but beneath it."
Between the walls of the mountains and the waters of the lake lay a sandy shore which, at its greatest breadth, measured 500 feet. On this soil one might easily make the tour of the lake. But the base of the high partitions was stony ground, with volcanic rocks and enormous pumice stones lying in picturesque heaps. All these detached masses, covered with enamel, polished by the action of the subterraneous fires, shone resplendent by the light of our electric lantern. The mica dust from the shore, rising under our feet, flew like a cloud of sparks. The bottom now rose sensibly, and we soon arrived at long circuitous slopes or inclined planes, which took us higher by degrees. But we were obliged to walk carefully among these conglomerates, bound by no cement, the feet slipping on the glassy crystal, feldspar, and quartz. The volcanic nature of this enormous excavation was confirmed on all sides, and I pointed it out to my companions.
"Picture to yourselves," said I, "what this crater must have been when filled with boiling lava, and when the level of the incandescent liquid rose to the orifice of the mountain, as though melted on the top of a hot plate."
"I can picture it perfectly," said Conseil. "But, sir, will you tell me why the great architect has suspended operations, and how it is that the furnace is replaced by the quiet waters of the lake?"
"Most probably, Conseil, because some convulsion beneath the ocean produced that very opening which has served as a passage for the Nautilus. Then the waters of the Atlantic rushed into the interior of the mountain. There must have been a terrible struggle between the two elements, a struggle which ended in the victory of Neptune. But many ages have run out since then, and the submerged volcano is now a peaceable grotto."
"Very well," replied Ned Land. "I accept the explanation, sir. But in our own interests, I regret that the opening of which you speak was not made above the level of the sea."
"But, friend Ned," said Conseil,
"if the passage had not been under the sea, the Nautilus could not have gone through it." We continued ascending. The steps became more and more perpendicular and narrow. Deep excavations, which we were obliged to cross, cut them here and there. Sloping masses had to be turned. We slid upon our knees and crawled along. But Conseil's dexterity and the Canadian's strength surmounted all obstacles. At a height of about 31 feet, the nature of the ground changed without becoming more practicable. To the conglomerate and trachyte succeeded black basalt, the first dispread in layers full of bubbles, the latter forming regular prisms, placed like a colonnade supporting the spring of the immense vault, an admirable specimen of natural architecture. Between the blocks of basalt wound long streams of lava, long since grown cold, encrusted with bituminous rays, and in some places there were spread large carpets of sulfur. A more powerful light shone through the upper crater, shedding a vague glimmer over these volcanic depressions forever buried in the bosom of this extinguished mountain. But our upward march was soon stopped at a height of about 250 feet by impassable obstacles. There was a complete vaulted arch overhanging us, and our ascent was changed to a circular walk. At the last change, vegetable life began to struggle with the mineral. Some shrubs, and even some trees, grew from the fractures of the walls. I recognized some euphorbias, with the caustic sugar coming from them. Heliotropes, quite incapable of justifying their name, sadly drooped their clusters of flowers, both their color and perfume half gone. Here and there some chrysanthemums grew timidly at the foot of an aloe with long, sickly-looking leaves. But between the streams of lava, I saw some little violets still slightly perfumed, and I admit that I smelt them with delight. Perfume is the soul of the flower, and sea flowers have no soul. We had arrived at the foot of some sturdy dragon trees, which had pushed aside the rocks with their strong roots, when Ned Land exclaimed, "Ah, sir, a hive, a hive!"
"A hive?"
I replied, with a gesture of incredulity.
"Yes, a hive," repeated the Canadian, "and bees humming round it."
I approached, and was bound to believe my own eyes. There at a hole bored in one of the dragon trees were some thousands of these ingenious insects, so common in all the Canaries, and whose produce is so much esteemed. Naturally enough, the Canadian wished to gather the honey, and I could not well oppose his wish. A quantity of dry leaves mixed with sulfur he lit with a spark from his flint, and he began to smoke out the bees. The humming ceased by degrees, and the hive eventually yielded several pounds of the sweetest honey, with which Ned Land filled his haversack.
"When I have mixed this honey with the paste of the breadfruit," said he, "I shall be able to offer you a succulent cake."
"Upon my word," said Conseil, "it will be gingerbread."
"Never mind the gingerbread," said I. "Let us continue our interesting walk."
At every turn of the path we were following, the lake appeared in all its length and breadth. The lantern lit up the whole of its peaceable surface, which knew neither ripple nor wave. The Nautilus remained perfectly immovable. On the platform and on the mountain, the ship's crew were working like black shadows clearly carved against the luminous atmosphere. We were now going round the highest crest of the first layers of rock which upheld the roof. I then saw that bees were not the only representatives of the animal kingdom in the interior of this volcano. Birds of prey hovered here and there in the shadows, or fled from their nests on the top of the rocks. There were sparrowhawks with white breasts, and kestrels, and down the slopes scampered with their long legs several fine fat bustards. I leave anyone to imagine the covetousness of the Canadian at the sight of this savory game, and whether he did not regret having no gun. But he did his best to replace the lead by stones, and after several fruitless attempts he succeeded in wounding a magnificent bird. To say that he risked his life 20 times before reaching it is but the truth. But he managed so well that the creature joined the honey cakes in his bag. We were now obliged to descend toward the shore, the crest becoming impracticable. Above us the crater seemed to gape like the mouth of a well, From this place the sky could be clearly seen, and the clouds, dissipated by the west wind, leaving behind them, even on the summit of the mountain, their misty remnants, certain proof that they were only moderately high, for the volcano did not rise more than 800 feet above the level of the ocean. Half an hour after the Canadians' last exploit, we had regained the inner shore. Here the flora was represented by large carpets of marine crystal, a little umbelliferous plant very good to pickle, which also bears the name of Pierce Stone and Sea Fennel. Conseil gathered some bundles of it. As to the fauna, it might be counted by thousands of crustacea of all sorts, lobsters, crabs, spider crabs, chameleon shrimps, and a large number of shells, rockfish, and limpets. 3/4 of an hour later we had finished our circuitous walk and were on board. The crew had just finished loading the sodium, and the Nautilus could have left that instant. But Captain Nemo gave no order. Did he wish to wait until night, and leave the submarine passage secretly? Perhaps so. Whatever it might be, the next day the Nautilus, having left its port, steered clear of all land at a few yards beneath the waves of the Atlantic. Chapter 11. The Sargasso Sea. That day the Nautilus crossed a singular part of the Atlantic Ocean. No one can be ignorant of the existence of a current of warm water known by the name of the Gulf Stream. After leaving the Gulf of Florida, we went in the direction of Spitsbergen. But before entering the Gulf of Mexico, about 45 degrees of north latitude, this current divides into two arms, the principal one going towards the coast of Ireland and Norway, whilst the second bends to the south about the height of the Azores. Then, touching the African shore, and describing a lengthened oval, returns to the Antilles. This second arm, it is rather a collar than an arm, surrounds with its circles of warm water that portion of the cold, quiet, immovable ocean called the Sargasso Sea, a perfect lake in the open Atlantic. It takes no less than 3 years for the great current to pass round it. Such was the region the Nautilus was now visiting. A perfect meadow, a close carpet of seaweed, fucus, and tropical berries, so thick and so compact that the stem of a vessel could hardly tear its way through it. And Captain Nemo, not wishing to entangle his crew in this herbaceous mass, kept some yards beneath the surface of the waves. The name Sargasso comes from the Spanish word sargazo, which signifies kelp. This kelp, or berry plant, is the principal formation of this immense bank. And this is the reason why these plants unite in the peaceful basin of the Atlantic. The only explanation which can be given, he says, seems to me to result from the experience known to all the world. Place in a vase some fragments of cork or other floating body, and give to the water in the vase a circular movement. The scattered fragments will unite in a group in the center of the liquid surface, that is to say, in the part least agitated. In the phenomenon we are considering, the Atlantic is the vase, the Gulf Stream the circular current, and the Sargasso Sea the central point at which the floating bodies unite. I share Maury's opinion, and I was able to study the phenomenon in the very midst, where vessels rarely penetrate. Above us floated products of all kinds, heaped up among these brownish plants. Trunks of trees torn from the Andes or the Rocky Mountains, and floated by the Amazon or the Mississippi. Numerous wrecks, remains of keels, or ships' bottoms, side planks stove in, and so weighted with shells and barnacles that they could not again rise to the surface. And time will one day justify Maury's other opinion, that these substances thus accumulated for ages will become petrified by the action of the water, and will then form inexhaustible coal mines, a precious reserve prepared by far-seeing nature for the moment when men shall have exhausted the mines of the continents. In the midst of this inextricable mass of plants and seaweed, I noticed some charming pink halcyons and actiniae, with their long tentacles trailing after them, and medusae, green, red, and blue. All the day of the 22nd of February we passed in the Sargasso Sea, where such fish as are partial to marine plants find abundant nourishment. The next, the ocean had returned to its accustomed aspect. From this time, for 19 days, from the 23rd of February to the 12th of March, the Nautilus kept in the middle of the Atlantic, carrying us at a constant speed of 100 leagues in 24 hours. Captain Nemo evidently intended accomplishing his submarine program, and I imagine that he intended, after doubling Cape Horn, to return to the Australian seas of the Pacific. Ned Land had cause for fear. In these large seas, void of islands, we could not attempt to leave the boat. Nor had we any means of opposing Captain Nemo's will. Our only course was to submit. But what we could neither gain by force nor cunning, I like to think might be obtained by persuasion. This voyage ended, would he not consent to restore our liberty, under an oath never to reveal his existence? An oath of honor which we should have religiously kept. But we must consider that delicate question with the captain. But was I free to claim this liberty? Had he not himself said from the beginning, in the firmest manner, that the secret of his life exacted from him our lasting imprisonment on board the Nautilus? And would not my 4 months' silence appear to him a tacit acceptance of our situation? And would not a return to the subject result in raising suspicions which might be hurtful to our projects, if at some future time a favorable opportunity offered to return to them? During the 19 days mentioned above, no incident of any kind happened to signalize our voyage. I saw little of the captain. He was at work. In the library, I often found his books left open, especially those on natural history. My work on submarine depths, conned over by him, was covered with marginal notes, often contradicting my theories and systems. But the captain contented himself with thus purging my work. It was very rare for him to discuss it with me. Sometimes I heard the melancholy tones of his organ, but only at night, in the midst of the deepest obscurity, when the Nautilus slept upon the deserted ocean. During this part of our voyage we sailed whole days on the surface of the waves. The sea seemed abandoned. A few sailing vessels on the road to India were making for the Cape of Good Hope. One day we were followed by the boats of a whaler, who, no doubt, took us for some enormous whale of great price. But Captain Nemo did not wish the worthy fellows to lose their time and trouble, so ended the chase by plunging under the water. Our navigation continued until the 13th of March. That day the Nautilus was employed in taking soundings, which greatly interested me. We had then made about 13,000 leagues since our departure from the high seas of the Pacific. The bearings gave us 45 degrees 37 minutes south latitude, and 37 degrees 53 minutes west longitude. It was the same water in which Captain Denham of the Herald sounded 7,000 fathoms without finding the bottom. There, too, Lieutenant Parker, of the American frigate Congress, could not touch the bottom with 15,140 fathoms. Captain Nemo intended seeking the bottom of the ocean by a diagonal sufficiently lengthened by means of lateral planes placed at an angle of 45 degrees with the waterline of the Nautilus. Then the screw set to work at its maximum speed, its four blades beating the waves with indescribable force. Under this powerful pressure, the hull of the Nautilus quivered like a sonorous cord, and sank regularly under the water. At 7,000 fathoms I saw some blackish tops rising from the midst of the waters. But these summits might belong to high mountains like the Himalayas or Mont Blanc, even higher. And the depth of the abyss remained incalculable. The Nautilus descended still lower, in spite of the great pressure. I felt the steel plates tremble at the fastenings of the bolts. Its bars bent, its partitions groaned. The windows of the saloon seemed to curve under the pressure of the waters. And this firm structure would doubtless have yielded, if, as its captain had said, it had not been capable of resistance like a solid block. We had attained a depth of 16,000 yards, 4 leagues, and the sides of the Nautilus then bore a pressure of 1,600 atmospheres, that is to say 3,200 pounds to each square 2/5 of an inch of its surface.
"What a situation to be in," I exclaimed, "to overrun these deep regions where man has never trod. Look, Captain, look at these magnificent rocks, these uninhabited grottos, these lowest receptacles of the globe, where life is no longer possible. What unknown sights are here? Why should we be unable to preserve a remembrance of them?"
"Would you like to carry away more than the remembrance?" said Captain Nemo.
"What do you mean by those words?"
"I mean to say that nothing is easier than to make a photographic view of this submarine region."
I had not time to express my surprise at this new proposition, when, at Captain Nemo's call, a camera was brought into the saloon. Through the widely opened panel, the liquid mass was bright with electricity, which was distributed with such uniformity that not a shadow, not a gradation, was to be seen in our manufactured light. The Nautilus remained motionless, the force of its screw subdued by the inclination of its planes. The instrument was propped on the bottom of the oceanic site, and in a few seconds we had obtained a perfect negative. But the operation being over, Captain Nemo said, "Let us go up. We must not abuse our position, nor expose the Nautilus too long to such great pressure."
"Go up again," I exclaimed.
"Hold well on."
I had not time to understand why the captain cautioned me thus, when I was thrown forward onto the carpet. At a signal from the captain, its screw was shipped, and its blades raised vertically. The Nautilus shot into the air like a balloon, rising with stunning rapidity, and cutting the mass of waters with a sonorous agitation. Nothing was visible, and in 4 minutes it had shot through the 4 leagues which separated it from the ocean, and after emerging like a flying fish, fell, making the waves rebound to an enormous height.
Chapter 12. Cachalots and Whales. During the nights of the 13th and 14th of March, the Nautilus returned to its southerly course. I fancied that, when on a level with Cape Horn, he would turn the helm westward, in order to beat the Pacific seas, and so complete the tour of the world. He did nothing of the kind, but continued on his way to the southern regions. Where was he going to? To the pole? It was madness. I began to think that the captain's temerity justified Ned Land's fears. For some time past, the Canadian had not spoken to me of his projects of flight. He was less communicative, almost silent. I could see that this lengthened imprisonment was weighing upon him, and I felt that rage was burning within him. When he met the captain, his eyes lit up with suppressed anger, and I feared that his natural violence would lead him into some extreme. That day, the 14th of March, Conseil and he came to me in my room. I inquired the cause of their visit.
"A simple question to ask you, sir," replied the Canadian.
"Speak, Ned."
"How many men are there on board the Nautilus, do you think?"
"I cannot tell, my friend."
"I should say that its working does not require a large crew."
"Certainly, under existing conditions, 10 men at the most ought to be enough."
"Well, why should there be any more?"
"Why?" I replied, looking fixedly at Ned Land, whose meaning was easy to guess.
"Because," I added, "if my surmises are correct, and if I have well understood the captain's existence, the Nautilus is not only a vessel. It is also a place of refuge for those who, like its commander, have broken every tie upon earth."
"Perhaps so," said Conseil. "But, in any case, the Nautilus can only contain a certain number of men. Could not you, sir, estimate their maximum?"
"How, Conseil?"
"By calculation. Given the size of the vessel, which you know, sir, and consequently the quantity of air it contains, knowing also how much each man expends at a breath, and comparing these results with the fact that the Nautilus is obliged to go to the surface every 24 hours.
Conseil had not finished the sentence before I saw what he was driving at.
"I understand," said I, "but that calculation, though simple enough, can give but a very uncertain result."
"Never mind,"
said Ned Land urgently.
"Here it is, then," said I. "In 1 hour each man consumes the oxygen contained in 20 gallons of air, and in 24 that contained in 480 gallons. We must therefore find how many times 480 gallons of air the Nautilus contains."
"Just so," said Conseil.
"Or," I continued, "the size of the Nautilus being 1,500 tons, and 1 ton holding 200 gallons, it contains 300,000 gallons of air, which, divided by 480, gives a quotient of 625. Which means to say, strictly speaking, that the air contained in the Nautilus would suffice for 625 men for 24 hours.
625, repeated Ned.
"But remember that all of us, passengers, sailors, and officers included, would not form a tenth part of that number."
"Still too many for 3 men, murmured Conseil. The Canadian shook his head, passed his hand across his forehead, and left the room without answering.
"Will you allow me to make one observation, sir?" said Conseil. "Poor Ned is longing for everything that he cannot have. His past life is always present to him. Everything that we are forbidden, he regrets. His head is full of old recollections. And we must understand him. What has he to do here? Nothing. He is not learned like you, sir, and has not the same taste for the beauties of the sea that we have. He would risk everything to be able to go once more into a tavern in his own country."
Certainly the monotony on board must seem intolerable to the Canadian, accustomed as he was to a life of liberty and activity. Events were rare which could rouse him to any show of spirit. But that day an event did happen which recalled the bright days of the harpooner. About 11 in the morning, being on the surface of the ocean, the Nautilus fell in with a troop of whales, an encounter which did not astonish me, knowing that these creatures, hunted to death, had taken refuge in high latitudes. We were seated on the platform with a quiet sea. The month of October in those latitudes gave us some lovely autumnal days. It was the Canadian, he could not be mistaken, who signaled a whale on the eastern horizon. Looking attentively, one might see its black back rise and fall with the waves 5 miles from the Nautilus. "Ah!" exclaimed Ned Land. "If I was on board a whaler now, such a meeting would give me pleasure. It is one of large size. See with what strength its blowholes throw up columns of air and steam. Confound it, why am I bound to these steel plates?"
"What, Ned?" said I. "You have not forgotten your old ideas of fishing?
Can a whale fisher ever forget his old trade, sir? Can he ever tire of the emotions caused by such a chase?"
"You have never fished in these seas, Ned?"
"Never, sir. In the northern only, and as much in Bering as in Davis Straits."
"Then the southern whale is still unknown to you.
It is the Greenland whale you have hunted up to this time, and that would not risk passing through the warm waters of the equator. Whales are localized according to their kinds in certain seas which they never leave. And if one of these creatures went from Bering to Davis Straits, it must be simply because there is a passage from one sea to the other, either on the American or the Asiatic side. In that case, as I have never fished in these seas, I do not know the kind of whale frequenting them."
"I have told you, Ned."
"A greater reason for making their acquaintance," said Conseil.
"Look! Look!" exclaimed the Canadian. "They approach! They aggravate me! They know that I cannot get at them!"
Ned stamped his feet. His hand trembled, as he grasped an imaginary harpoon.
"Are these cetaceans as large as those of the northern seas?" asked he.
"Very nearly, Ned."
"Because I have seen large whales, sir, whales measuring 100 feet. I have even been told that those of Hulamuk and Umgallik of the Aleutian Islands are sometimes 150 feet long."
"That seems to me exaggeration. These creatures are generally much smaller than the Greenland whale."
"Ah!" exclaimed the Canadian, whose eyes had never left the ocean. "They are coming nearer. They are in the same water as the Nautilus."
Then